From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, in part two of a special holiday edition of On Point, we bring you more from this year's New Yorker Festival. In fiction, the fresh young voice of Zadie Smith reading a story of one woman's confrontation with her past, Sarajevo-born Alexander Hamon's story of a loss of innocence and country, and Sherman Alexie's short story of an Indian grandmother pawning her powwow regalia. Plus, we'll sit in on a conversation with actor Nick Nolte and another with Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz on spreading democracy in the Middle East. And we'll hear from Frank Rich and Bill Kristol on the bent of the American media tonight on Point, part two of highlights from the fourth annual New Yorker Festival. Writer Susan Orlean introduced Maverick actor Nick Nolte with a confession. His role in the television miniseries Rich Man, Poor Man had made her high school life complete, she said. Since that breakthrough role in 1975, Nick Nolte has starred in more than 40 films and had Oscar nominations for his roles in Affliction and Prince of Tides. Here's Susan Orlean in conversation with Nick Nolte on the craft of acting, fame, and Marlon Brando's makeup.
How far in advance do you start thinking about the character?
No, I like to have a couple of years. I could get a couple of years every time, it'd be great.
And then what do you do? How do you spend that time?
You get a little shot of it. Like, I'm preparing a film called Found in the Streets, Patricia Highsmith novel. And then tonight I'll probably go and see bits of the neighborhood where he might live. And I'll just add to it slowly. And let a lot of it just develop unconsciously. And then as I really get down to it, specific, then I try to break down the script in as many ways as it possibly can. The way I've found it is that it pretty much syncs up with where you're at in life. That's what you should do. I started in the theater by chasing writers. I chased Tennessee Williams. I chased Arthur Miller. I chased William Inge, and I didn't care what arena it was in. As long as I got to touch those roles when I needed to touch them, mm-hmm. when I had the confusion of the character. And that was basically the discovery. And so my job was fascinating. It always fed into my life. And then as film came along, which was a whole different thing, you have the temptations of doing things that you don't sync up. And that's a monetary issue. And you sell out. And there are some of your worst work you can possibly do.
What's it like to give up a private life? And what part of it has been enjoyable? What part of it has been hard? For one thing, someone from People magazine came by and reminded you that you'd been the sexiest man in 19, whatever it was.
22. It's this odd hypocrisy of it. And the only way I can explain it is I had an old Ford International truck, and I couldn't get a starter for it. And so we had been down to this auto parts place and trying to get this starter. And they were kind of rude and said, and Rich Man, Poor Man came out. And I got a call the very next day from this place. And they said, Mr. Nolte, we have your starter. And I said, well, that's great. And they said, come on down and get it. So I went down. And they not only had the starter, they gave it to me free. And I had my pictures taken with all the people and all that. And my friend Rocky was with me, and we walked outside, and Rocky said, he said, you know, there's something wrong about that. He said, when you don't have it, they won't give it to you. And when you have it, they give it to you. So there's... if you let it get to you, you can take things for granted. You know, you can get so caught up with assistance and things like that. You can forget how to use a phone. And you just have to wait a few films. A couple of them don't work.
And you remember.
Yeah, and then you learn how to be a human being again real quickly. We just did a thing, Marlon Brando, just he held a two-week seminar on acting. And
Marlon Brando?
Yeah.
How come I wasn't called?
I don't know. By the end of the week, and there were lines of people trying to get into these classes that he was doing. There were some drama students, there were homeless people, and a bunch of old fogey movie stars.
Who do you really admire? Is he one of the people you...
Oh, yeah, Marlon you'd have to admire, you know. I knew Steiger well, because Rod always told me he was the best actor that ever lived. But any connection with an older actor is precious. Mm-hmm. And it's not that the older actor is doing anything better than what you're doing. It's kind of a validation of the process. Marlon's first thing he did was sit in a chair. We were all sitting. He had a relaxed chair, and he wasn't up on a platform or anything. And he took out a mirror, and he proceeded to put on red lipstick. And we were teetering and laughing, you know. He's got red lipstick on. Did he ask anybody had some eyeshadow? No, he's got eyeshadow. And then he went on to explain that he's made a complete fool of himself, he can act.
Actor Nick Nolte being interviewed by novelist and New Yorker contributor Susan Orlean. When novelist Alexander Hemon arrived in the United States from his native Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1992, he knew only what he calls tourist-level English. 3 years later, he began writing in English, creating vivid pictures of life as an exile in wartime. His new novel is Nowhere Man. In it, he tells the story of Joseph Pronik, who came of age in Sarajevo during a time of relative prosperity and innocence, like the novelist who created him. Here is Alexander Hemon reading from Nowhere Man.
Joseph Pronik was born in the Sarajevo Maternity Hospital on September 10, 1967, after 37 hours of excruciating labor, the culmination of which was his mother's oath, as Joseph's little head was stuck between her legs halfway into the world, that she would strangle him with her own hands if he didn't come out immediately. His mother regretted her threat the moment she saw his crumpled face, dominated by a screaming mouth like an expressionist painting. In her delirium, she found it extraordinarily beautiful. On little Joseph's part, all he can remember, he still implausibly claims, from that day, the first in an as yet unconcluded sequence of days that constitute his life, was a frightening deluge of blazing light coming at him through the window pane, as if the first thing he ever saw were a nuclear explosion. As for Joseph's toddlerhood, it was rather more eventful. His drunken uncle Dragan, who would many years later, driving to the seaside through the Neretva Canyon, give a left-turn signal and steer his car into the abyss, dangled him over the balcony fence. Gravity stretched out his crooked little legs and strained his arms to the verge of shoulder dislocation. And then, a little later, the girl troubles begin. It was in the summer after the fifth grade that a small reconnaissance unit of pubertal hormones, the avant-garde of a great army, entered the unconquered Pronik territory. He was spending a couple of seaside vacation weeks with his parents in Gradac. He absorbed sun on the beach, swam in the deep waters, hoping to encounter some dolphins. He had noticed before that there were girls who didn't have to wear a swimsuit top, and that there were girls who did. But for the first time that summer, he realized that there was a fundamental difference between them. So much so that he got a slap on the back of his head for staring at a girl in a pink swimsuit, her nipples swollen. In the evenings when pines gave off bounteous resin smells, when the breeze of the cooling sea brought forth tickling saltiness, when warm bodies exuded coconut milky sun lotion scent, there was a dance for kids at the hotel. The first evening, Pronik spotted a long-legged girl with her hair bleached by the sun, clearly playing for the top wearers. She was dancing with her father, a burly man in a white undershirt, his belly bulging forward. Pronik circled around her like a hawk until she noticed him and smiled at him, whereupon he circled some more as hormone reinforcements kept arriving at the front. The second evening, the circles narrowed. He stopped in front of her, his head still spinning, and asked her to dance. His attitude aimed to suggest that he wanted to dance only because there was absolutely nothing else to do. They clumsily danced like infatuated zombies, avoiding bodily contact, yet craving it. By the end of the first week, they were spending time on the beach together. Her name was Susana, and she was from Belgrade. At the beach, they had to perform a complicated glance dance, eschewing looking at each other's interesting areas. Midway through the second week, they could not hold themselves back, their lips stiffly touched, their teeth clacking. They were sitting right at the waterline, tiny waves crawling between their toes, Pronik's arm over her shoulder like a dead fish. The sun was setting, providing a tacky orange spill that often appears on postcards and can still bring tears to Pronik's eyes. By the end of the second week, as his departure was looming on the glum horizon, Pronik licked her ear. As his hand was resting on her belly, paralyzed in the nether area between the two fantastic possibilities. He then proposed, determined to spend the rest of his life with her. She, however, needed to ask her father, an army colonel with a frighteningly hairy chest. He, of course, forbade her to see Pronik ever again, an order she bravely defied. They met for the last time in the bushes behind the hotel. They squatted, whispering the vows of love. With her head on his shoulder, her tears trickling into his armpit, Pronik sorcerously sang, "My Bonnie lies over the ocean," trying hard not to keel over onto a used condom someone left behind, his throat tight with sorrow. By the time he got back home in Sarajevo, the Pronik territory had been fully conquered. Mirza informed him in an audibly deeper voice that he was considering shaving his legs as they were far too hairy. Shortly after the new school year started, Pronik received a letter from Susana, barely mentioning their eternal love and containing a picture of her friend, a lanky pimplehead in a Sex Pistols t-shirt with the fine name of Tadija. They learned more songs for the late party hours, going deeper into the feeling that Bosnians call sevdah, a feeling of pleasant soul pain when you are at peace with your woeful life, which allows you to enjoy this very moment with abandon. And there were moments. Sarajevo in the 80s was a beautiful place to be young. I know, because I was young then. I remember linden trees blooming as if they were never to bloom again, producing a smell I can feel in my nostrils now. The boys were handsome, the girls beautiful, the sports team successful, the bands good, the streets felt as soft as a Persian carpet, and the Winter Olympics made everyone feel that we were at the center of the world. I remember the smell of an apartment building basement where I was making out with my date, the eye of the light switch glaring at us from the darkness. Then the light would go on, a neighbor coming down the stairs, and we would pull apart. I also remember that a thug nicknamed Nixon sold me a brick and smacked me around in front of my girlfriend. I remember that my apartment was broken into and that there were two footprints on my parents' bed. I remember the hateful moments in crowded smoky bars when I could not stand to look again at the faces I had known since birth. I remember the guy in the hospital bed next to mine whose thighs and ass were all cut up after a toilet bowl fell apart under him. But I choose not to think of these as important, my memories irrevocably coated in linden syrup. Let's go back to my friends.
Alexander Hamon reading from his novel Nowhere Man at the New Yorker Festival. He's currently at work on a second novel. There's more to come after the break when we present fiction writers Zadie Smith, Sherman Alexie, and more reading from their work. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is a special edition of On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, in a special edition of On Point, we're presenting highlights from the 2003 New Yorker Festival. Writer Zadie Smith won a Whitbread Award for her first novel, White Teeth. The 24-year-old Londoner tackles subjects like race and assimilation with a fresh wit and confidence. Here she reads from The Trials of Finch, a short story that tells the story of a middle-aged woman who's been taken in by three posh London divorcees. Finch feels exalted by being asked to serve as a juror in a murder case and haunted by an untried crime in her own past. Here's Zadie Smith reading from The Trials of Finch.
Finch had three friends, Claire, Karen and Jemima. These were tall, lucky, professional English women in their early 40s who'd been ever so kind to Finch and who felt with some reason that they'd saved her. It was a friendship so unlikely it had the color of charity. By befriending her, they plucked poor Finch from the very edge of something, stopped her from slipping down a notch to join the lonely mad, who were visible everywhere in Hampstead with their sticks and props and wigs, effortful, bent. Because of her friends, Finch was not one of these people. She had a job, and she didn't fear the London Underground or any of its African employees with their blue caps and bloodshot eyes. And she'd been persuaded, after a battle, to give up long, bright socks and men's suspenders. She no longer kept food loose in her pockets. It turned out that Finch wasn't mad at all. She was merely an eccentric. Of course, at a certain point in her life, Finch had lived through a bad day. One might guess that much simply by meeting her. But would it be clear how bad? Finch was 11 at the time. She was wearing green pantaloons with a fleur-de-lis pattern, a white shirt with puffy shoulders, red leather sandals, and pink socks with feminine frills at the ankle. She carried a small clasp purse made of milky, iridescent beads, a few of which were found later, sitting guilty in the sand. Her name, her real name, was Rosalind Jane Gordon. She was on holiday, staying with her parents in a bed and breakfast in Padstow, Cornwall, and as the air turned salt and people hunted the wet beach below, Finch began to understand the enormity of the things she'd done, and she hid in the shed. The children in question were called Beth and Andrew Cotton, 8 years old and six. Finch met them that same afternoon. They'd wandered down to where she was rock pooling. The boy stood behind his sister as Finch fearlessly picked up a crab and let it scuttle around in the basin of her cupped hands. Finch showed them the circular coils that worms leave in the sand as they work their way down, and how to stand with just your feet in the water while the surf and the beach seem to draw thunderously away from you. But then the children had grown bored. Finch felt an odd adult pressure to entertain them. And on a sudden inspiration, she took Beth and Andrew for a walk over the dunes, up mighty Trevose Head, scrambling and laughing. When Andrew felt a stinging cut between his toes, Finch stopped and picked the sand out and wiped it clean with a leaf. But she was bossy, the 11-year-old Finch, as well as maternal. When she was finished, she made him walk on, though he was complaining and wanted to stop. They went high up onto the very tip of a crag. Then the three of them sat while Finch prepared a fictional picnic amid the long, itchy grass, imaginary plates, imaginary knives and forks, dishes her mother cooked, cakes she'd made. Finch had known the children now for about an hour and a half. Beth was pretty in that ideal English golden rose way. Much was made of this later. And Andrew was paler, white, blonde, no eyebrows. Very bright, very popular, both of them, but Finch could not know this. So how did they upset Finch, these two? What was their offense? Refusing to acknowledge that it was an invisible loaf sitting in the empty hand she held out, maybe. That was as close as Finch ever came to remembering why she turned her little hands and pushed. Later it became important to say it very clearly, without poetry and in the first person, with my hands, I pushed them off the edge, I killed them. And this, in other therapeutic adult hands, became... The two younger children refused to collude with the imaginary creation of the elder child, and so she, already pathologically disassociated from the idea of the sovereignty of other people, due to sustained violence at the hands of the father, unleashed her ability to make the imaginary happen. But no matter how the story was told, it remained a remarkable, singularly awful thing to have happened. There is a kindness that says it could have happened to anyone, And then there is the one-way, merciless velocity that actions have in the world, which means that it happened only to Finch. She did the pushing, and over the children went. Hello, Finch, and goodbye. Finch's biographer has to begin here, in this pale place, where Finch's life, her independent existence, seemed to finish. A children's care facility called Farrington in Southampton on the coast. She spent 10 years there. And because her photograph had been widely published and the story a sensation, Finch was treated brutally by people who made it their sport to try and destroy her. She was raped by a junior care worker and said nothing about it. Her right arm was broken. In short, everything unfolded in the institutional style of the time, including the therapy. Finch was made to enlarge and solidify that day in Padstow until it was a monumental disc that blacked out the sun. There was never any trial for Finch, and no prison. And the curiosity of her case from the therapeutic point of view was how much her late teens came to be filled with a longing for a jury and for punishment. She fell in love with the idea of a judge, the way other young girls envision their princes.
Zadie Smith reading from The Trials of Finch. In the story's conclusion, Finch feels uniquely qualified to judge the defendant, Danica, who stands accused of killing her lover, but Finch's eccentric speeches are ignored. Frustrated and desperate, she reveals her infamous identity in a letter to the other sequestered jurors, reawakening the dark story of her teenage years.
And so Finch's jury meets again in the afternoon. She can see they've all breakfasted together without her. And everybody sits around the table in odd positions of pity and disgust, legs folded and bent in a double helix. And Finch stands alone by the coffee machine, pressing down on the dispenser for something hot, while every human feeling for her seeps from the room. The jury's idea is that Danica, at least, was a victim. Finch never was. She was never elevated to one. She never got that far, and she never will. Finch knows she's being looked at and read backwards. Were there signs? Could one have seen? And didn't she always seem rather? In the courtroom that same day, as the jury stands, Finch's photograph, so fast. Outside the court, no one is there to pick her up, so fast. She pushes onto a bus, and this same photographer appears in front of her, and she knows there'll be more at the house. She walks Hampstead Heath very slowly, as Keats must have, thinking of trees, their long lives beyond reproach. Oh, to understand poetry, to Finch, this is the height of sophistication, to understand that the moment, crystalline, encased in amber words, perfect, is enough, to be all done with stories. When the time comes, she barges through the people forest and very nearly makes it to her front door without raising her head to a flashbulb. Only someone calls her old name. She turns, and an old woman, dressed smartly like a politician, says something quiet and obscene.
Novelist Zadie Smith, author of White Teeth and the Autograph Man, reading from her short story, The Trials of Finch. Poet, novelist, and musician Sherman Alexie was born on a Spokane Coeur d'Alene Indian reservation in Washington State. He began writing poetry and fiction and received a Penn Hemingway Award for The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. The collection of short stories became the screenplay for the 1999 film Smoke Signals. Sherman Alexie's wry humor and vernacular delivery come alive here in the excerpts from What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. It's from a day in the life of Jackson Jackson, who, on his way to buy some cheap wine, spots his grandmother's powwow regalia in a pawn shop window.
One day you have a home, and the next you don't, but I'm not going to tell you my particular reasons for being homeless, because it's my secret story, and Indians have to work hard to keep secrets from hungry white folk. I'm a Spokane Indian boy, an interior Salish, and my people have lived within a 100-mile radius of Spokane, Washington for at least 10,000 years. I grew up in Spokane, moved to Seattle 23 years ago for college, flunked out within two semesters, worked various blue and bluer collar jobs for many years, married two or three times, fathered two or three kids, and then went crazy. Of course, crazy is not the official definition for what's wrong with me, But I don't think asocial disorder fits it either, because that makes me sound like I'm a serial killer or something. And I've never hurt another human being, at least not physically. I mean, I've broken a few hearts in my time, but we've all done that, so I'm nothing special in that regard. I'm a boring heartbreaker at that, because I've never abandoned one woman for another. I never dated or married more than one woman at a time. I didn't break hearts overnight. I broke them slowly and carefully. I didn't set any land speed records running out the door. Piece by piece, I disappeared, and I've been disappearing ever since. But I'm not going to tell you anymore about my brain or my soul. I've been homeless for 6 years. If there's such a thing as being an effective homeless man, I suppose I'm effective. Being homeless is probably the only thing I've ever been good at. I know where to get the best free food. I've made friends with restaurant and convenience store managers who let me use their bathrooms. And I don't mean the public bathrooms either. I mean the employees' bathrooms, the clean ones hidden in the back of the kitchen or the pantry or the cooler. I know it sounds strange to be proud of, but it means a lot to me, being trustworthy enough to piss in somebody else's clean bathroom. Maybe you don't understand the value of a clean bathroom, but I do. Probably none of this interests you. I probably don't interest you much. Homeless Indians are everywhere in Seattle. We're common and boring, and you walk right on by us with maybe a look of anger or disgust or even sadness at the terrible fate of the noble savage. But we have dreams and families. I'm friends with a homeless Plains Indian man whose son is the editor of a big-time newspaper back east. That's his story, but we Indians are great storytellers and liars and myth-makers, so maybe that Plains Indian is just a plain old everyday Indian. I'm kind of suspicious of him because he describes himself only as Plains Indian, a generic term and not by a specific tribe. When I asked him why he wouldn't tell me exactly what he was, he said, "Do any of us know exactly what we are?" Yeah, great, a philosophizing Indian. "Hey," I said, "you got to have a home to be that homely." He laughed and flipped me the eagle and walked away. But you probably want to know more about the story I'm really trying to tell you. I wander the streets with a regular crew, my teammates, my defenders, my posse. It's Rose of Sharon Jr. and me. We matter to one another if we don't matter to anybody else. Rose of Sharon is a big woman, about 7 feet tall if you're measuring overall effect, and about 5 feet tall if you're talking about the physical. She's a Yakima Indian of the Wishram variety. Junior is a Colville, but there are about 199 tribes that make up the Colville, so he could be anything. He's good looking, though, just like he stepped out of one of those Don't Litter the Earth public service commercials. He's got those great big cheekbones that are like planets, you know, with little moons orbiting around them. He gets me jealous, jealous, and jealous. If you put Junior and me next to each other, he's the before Columbus arrived Indian, and I'm the after Columbus arrived Indian. I am living proof of the horrible damage that colonialism has done to us Indians. But I'm not going to let you know how scared I am sometimes of history and its ways. I'm a strong man, and I know silence is sometimes the best method of dealing with white folks.
Writer Sherman Alexie reading from What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. In this segment, Jackson Jackson and his two friends try to raise $999 to buy back his grandmother's regalia. He ends up getting drunk, provoking a bar fight, and waking up the next day on a railroad track with $20 in his pocket.
At 8 a.m. on the wharf, those Aleut guys were waiting on that wooden bench. "Have you seen your ship?" I asked. "Seen a lot of ships, but not our ship." I sat on the bench with them. We sat there in silence for a long, long indigenous time. I wondered whether we would fossilize. I thought about my grandma again. I'd never seen her dance in that regalia. More than anything, I wanted to see her dance. I wanted to see her dance at a powwow. "Do you guys know any songs?" "I know all of Hank Williams," the elder Aleut said. What about Indian songs? Hank Williams is Indian. What about sacred songs? Hank Williams is sacred. I'm talking about ceremonial songs, you know, religious ones. You know, the ones you sing back home when you're wishing and a-hoping. What are you wishing and a-hoping for? I'm wishing my grandmother was still alive. Every Indian song is about that. Well, then sing me as many as you can. They sang hundreds of songs. We sat there for a long time. And after the Aleuts finished their last song, we sat in silence. We are really good at silence, we Indians. Was that the last song I said? We sang all we could. All the rest are just for our people. Are you guys hungry? I said. They looked at one another and communicated without talking. We could eat. We walked over to the mother's kitchen in the International District. They didn't mind serving homeless Indians. You guys want separate checks? No, I said. I've got it. I've got $25 I can spend. Bring us all the breakfast you can, plus your tip. She knew the math. The Aleuts and I waited in silence. Soon enough, the waitress returned and poured us four coffees, and we sipped at them until she returned with four plates of eggs, bacon toast, hash brown potatoes. It's amazing how much food you can buy for so little money. We feasted. At noon, I said goodbye to the Aleuts and walked toward that pawn shop. I walked inside and greeted the pawnbroker, who looked a little younger than he had the day before. "It's you," he said. "Yeah, Jackson, Jackson. Where are your friends? One went traveling, but it's okay. Indians are everywhere. Do you have my money? How much do you need again?" I asked, hoping the price had lowered. $999. It was still the same price. Of course it was the same price. Why would it change? "I don't have that." "What do you have?" $5. I set the crumpled Lincoln on the countertop. The pawnbroker studied it. "Is that the same $5 from yesterday?" "No, it's different." He thought about the possibilities. "Did you work hard for this money?" "Yeah." He closed his eyes and thought harder about the possibilities. Then he stepped into his back room and returned with my grandmother's regalia. "Take it," he said, and held it out to me. "I don't have the money. I don't want your money. But I wanted to win it." "You did win it. Now take it before I change my mind. Do you know how many good men live in this world? More than you can count." I took my grandmother's regalia and walked outside. I knew that solitary yellow bead was part of me. I knew I was that yellow bead in part. Outside, I wrapped myself in my grandmother's regalia and breathed her in. I stepped off the sidewalk and into the intersection. Pedestrians stopped. Cars stopped. The city stopped. They all watched me dance with my grandmother. I was my grandmother, dancing.
Sherman Alexie, reading from the story What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. His newest collection of short stories is 10 Little Indians. We'll have more highlights from the 4th annual New Yorker Festival after the break. Up next, Paul Wolfowitz tangles with protesters, and Bill Kristol and Frank Rich debate the origins of media bias. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, in a special edition of On Point, we're listening to highlights from the 2003 New Yorker Festival. New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Goldberg introduced Paul Wolfowitz as perhaps the most famous and controversial deputy secretary in the executive branch.
He's burning books.
The appearance at New York's New School marked a rare public forum for the Deputy Secretary of Defense. After loud jeering and booing, House Security warned that any hecklers would be asked to leave, even before Wolfowitz had spoken a word.
Secretary Wolfowitz, thank you for joining us.
I think I'm glad to be here. Thank you. You know, I can't resist. This is what is wonderful about this country. It is. And what is finally wonderful, that roughly 50 million Afghans and Iraqis are finally able to speak this way without having their tongues cut out.
Paul Wolfowitz is considered a leader among the Bush administration's influential neoconservatives. He has vigorously championed promoting the role of democracy as an agent of global transformation. He talks about that mission in this excerpt.
When I became Assistant Secretary of State in 1982, there was one democracy in all of East Asia, that was Japan. One might say in the Middle East today, other than Israel, there's Turkey. Today, democracy is on the march in East Asia. It's come to the Philippines, it's come to Taiwan, it's come to South Korea. It's come to Indonesia in, unfortunately, terrible circumstances, but it's coming. It's come to Thailand. I think the optimists among us believe that over time, in an evolutionary way, it will come to China. That'll be a huge thing. I think the Middle East needs to make that same kind of progression. Maybe over a similar period of time. We're not talking about a problem that's going to suddenly turn around in 2 weeks or 5 months. And Americans' impatience is really something that we've got to get under control, I think. But the thing that really changed my perspective on Iraq, even though I'd studied it for a long time, was September 11th. It was not until September 11th that I or most other people I know would have contemplated the overt use of American military force to accomplish that. But it is, in fact, part of the larger war on terrorism. And here in New York, I think people have a particular sense, certainly we do in Washington, but the whole country understands that terrorism is not just a manageable evil that you live with, which was kind of the policy of the last 20 years. Terrorism really is something too dangerous to continue living with.
Is that the policy, by the way, of the Republican administrations in which you worked?
I think more or less, yes. I mean, if you look at what President Reagan did when we caught the Libyans doing terrorism in the Bell, what was it called, the discotheque in Berlin, we retaliated. We punished them after the fact. It was part of a framework that viewed terrorism as kind of a law enforcement proposition. When you catch criminals doing terrorist acts, you put them in jail. If you catch countries doing it, you retaliate. But it was believed that you could live with it on that scale and punishment would work. And I think what is clear now is punishment after the fact is too dangerous. And you need, in a broader way, to prevent. And prevent doesn't just mean killing and capturing terrorists. That's clearly a major part of the job. But it also means supporting moderate forces in the Muslim world particularly.
You've been criticized for fuzzing the difference, fuzzing the line between regional terrorism actors and global terrorism actors. Al-Qaeda, clearly a global terrorist group, with very shaky evidence proving that they had any connection to Iraq. We all know that Iraq sponsored some terror groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, some anti-Iranian groups, but these were local actors. Are you fuzzing the line between groups that pose a global threat, or pose a particular threat to the American homeland, rather than regional actors?
I don't think I'm fuzzing the line. I think it's the terrorists that fuzz the lines. And the lines between these groups are very blurry, and they cross constantly. And if you talk about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, for example, who is one of the principal terrorists that Secretary Powell mentioned in his UN Security Council speech, a terrorist who definitely operated out of northern Iraq, a terrorist who definitely was in Baghdad, and I find it hard to believe that anybody in Baghdad under the old regime, that anybody there is there without the knowledge of the regime. And he was, in fact, his specific location was identified to him by the Jordanians, and the Iraqis did nothing about him. He is tied to the groups that were arrested in London and Paris for these planned attacks on subways. I don't know if he's a card-carrying member of al-Qaeda. In fact, I don't think members of al-Qaeda carry membership cards. I think the lesson of September 11th is that this interlocking network of groups has the potential to do such enormous damage to us and frankly to civil liberties too, if you think about what the reaction could be to the kind of catastrophe they're working on, that you can no longer treat it the way we did for the last 20 years as one of those unhappy but necessary evils of the world. I think you have to think of these groups as simply unacceptable. They need to be eradicated. State sponsorship of terrorism is something that has to go on the ash heap of history.
Wouldn't you say, though, that based on that standard, Iran is a greater sponsor of terrorist groups than Iraq under Saddam Hussein?
We can get into debates about who's greater, who's lesser. There are also issues about how you deal with particular problems. But the fact is, in addition to everything else, Iraq was a country that had defied the international community for 12 years, defied some 16 UN Security Council resolutions, had basically declared war on the United States continually, continued to fire on our airplanes, was a sponsor of terrorism, and by the way, did have contacts with al-Qaeda. We don't know how clear they were, but it's a murky world where people try to hide these things. Everyone's had their view changed with September 11th. I think the sort of the optimist, but to me it's the ostrich attitude, would like to say September 11th was bin Laden and a few dozen of his key associates. If we can just get bin Laden, get those people, we can go back to business as usual and go back to the status quo of the last 20 years. And I don't think the status quo of the last 20 years is acceptable. I think it has to change in fundamental ways, and not just in Iraq, not just in Iran. It has to change in Saudi Arabia. It's starting to change. It has to change the Arab-Israeli issue has got to be moved towards settlement.
John Burns of the New York Times, who to my mind is probably the greatest living foreign correspondent, recently said, for some reason or another, Mr. Bush chose to make his principal case on weapons of mass destruction, which is still an open case. This war could have been justified any time on the basis of human rights alone. I know there are a lot of people across the country who say, you know what, Saddam Hussein was a monster. He committed genocide against the Kurds. He tortured children. He did all of these things. But there are a lot of countries in the world run by evil dictators. Why do we focus on Iraq?
Well, it's not the only country where we've tried to remove evil dictators. We worked on it in Serbia. We were eventually successful. We just got Charles Taylor out of Liberia. Each one of these situations is different. Some of them call for more outside intervention, others for less. I do think that Saddam Hussein is almost in a class by himself in terms of the number of people he murdered, the sadism and brutality of the regime. It's just truly monstrous. And I think people who don't bother reading the first minimum account about what life was like in Iraq and go screaming slogans, I think are missing the point here.
Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. Ken Oletta has been writing the Annals of Communication column for The New Yorker since 1993. Here he moderated a panel on media conspiracy with four prestigious observers and actors on the American media landscape. In this segment of the conversation, we'll hear first from New York Times columnist Frank Rich. Moderator Ken Oletta then addresses William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard and Fox News commentator. The final comment comes from The Nation columnist Eric Alterman.
I happen to believe that Bush did get a free pass after 9/11 from almost everybody, and particularly television news, and not just Fox by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, Eric has a very good column in the current issue of The Nation about we still don't even know what Bush did the morning of 9/11, and even Bush's own accounts of, and the White House accounts contradict each other. We're now learning there are all sorts of things that we were lied to about in the run-up to this war and perhaps during the war. And what was this about? Well, I don't even think it was about so much a built-in conservative bias, which people on the left would say with the same vehemence that people perhaps to the right of Bill might say that, you know, all the press is a liberal conspiracy. Again, I think of this entertainment, desire to get ratings, and the point Eric was making about television news, the money being bigger, that's true. That does separate it from print. Also, the circulation numbers are much more volatile. From year to year, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post circulation figures, they're tiny changes. But as we know, in television, including television news, there can be overnight changes that can end careers and end profits. My feeling was the moment you had networks like NBC, forget about Fox, putting the NBC Peacock in the corner of the screen in red, white, and blue, which to me, if there were a strong flag desecration law, we could put all GE executives in jail, showed that it was a bias. Now, was it a conservative bias? Was it a patriotic bias? Or was it a feeling... this sells, this is the mood of the country, this is popular in the way Friends is popular. Now,
But I mean it. I think, you know, and one of the consequences of this media consolidation is that show business people make these decisions, for better and worse. Now Bush's polls are slipping. They seem to be slipping quite badly. And my guess is we're going to get to a point where Bill can legitimately complain that now the press, and particularly television news, finds that Bush is doing nothing right, everything is a lie, everything he's doing is wrong, and it's a mixture of the PAC mentality and the showbiz incentive to frankly look at the polls, which can prefigure ratings.
From your mouth,
but Bill, you were criticizing the press last spring for basically the quagmire coverage, as you called it. Do you think that Bush has gotten a free ride?
No, I mean, I think any president would have gotten a very charitable and easy treatment from the press after 9/11 for a month, 2 months, maybe 6 months. I think it's patriotism, and one can criticize it if one wants, but it's hard. It would have been hard not to rally to a president at that point, and the American media did so because it's the American media, you know, they're part of America. There was no, in the 80s, there was no Fox News. Limbaugh didn't get going till what, sort of 90, 91, really. There's no Weekly Standard, almost as important. You know, the networks were much more dominant. There was no CNN to speak of, really, till the late 80s. It was the old world of media. Reagan wins by, 9 points in 80, 20 points in 84. Bush wins by 10 points in 88. Go to the 90s. Limbaugh's big. Conservative talk radio's big. Fox News comes on the scene. The Democrats win the popular vote in 3 straight presidential elections. I just wonder if one has to have some perspective. I don't think the media is unimportant. The way in which it frames the narrative and the way in which it can elevate certain issues and implicitly suppress others, the way in which I think it can be somewhat moderately conservative, I would say, on economics and quite moderately liberal on the social issues, probably colors people's views of certain things. But one shouldn't just get, you know, it's a very big country out there, and most people react to reality that they see around them in terms of the economy and the war and these things, and they see the candidates personally in debates, and they see advertising on both sides, and they have surrogates in their local governors and senators whom they listen to about these things, and just one shouldn't exaggerate the importance of the media. And I do come back to this fundamental fact that the Republicans had a pretty good run in the 80s at the presidential level when the liberal media was allegedly so powerful, and Democrats have had a pretty good run in the 90s when this conservative juggernaut was building up.
Eric, do you agree with Bill that the press is more footnote than power?
Not at all. I think that Bill and I talked about this on the radio. I go back to the famous distinction that Walter Lippmann made in his book Public Opinion, which is really the first book on media analysis, between the world outside and the pictures in our heads. And yes, there's the world outside, and I suppose it exists in some ontological sense, but what people really carry around are the pictures in their heads. And that's what the media creates.
Frank Rich, Ken Auletta, William Kristol, and Eric Altman on Media Bias, one of dozens of discussions that took place at the 4th Annual New Yorker Festival. More information on the festival and guests is available at our website at onpointradio.org. Our thanks to the writers and staff of The New Yorker for their partnership in bringing you this broadcast. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoog. With help from Sarah Cook, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. Special thanks tonight to Perry Dorset and Jody Bart at The New Yorker. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.